The next case is 05-1615, Cleveland Bar Association versus Michael Dadisman. Mr. Potash.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Lester Potash. I respectfully reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal purposes.
Time.
Your Honors, I stand here on behalf of Michael Dadisman, who has been summoned to show cause why the report and recommendation of the Board of Commissioners should not be adopted by this court. The recommendation is that Mr. Dadisman be disbarred, actually permanently disbarred, I guess is the phrase that is used. And but for, I guess, an 800-pound gorilla that permeates the entire issue here, the attitude may be a little bit different. But unfortunately, he has this major problem relating to a theft. I'm not minimizing it at all. But the question is what will this court do with this man who committed a theft, admitted to the theft, went to prison for the theft, has been suspended on an interim basis for the theft, and now seeks to try to put his life together. If we just look at what this court has said in the past about commit a theft, you're presumptively going to be disbarred. Those two dots that have to be connected are very narrow. But I am going to try to put a little space between the two dots to give you some cause as to why Michael Dadisman deserves a second chance. And I would submit that part of it goes to what the indefinite suspension constitutes, maybe what people think it is, but what in reality it is, and maybe shift this court's attention or focus in a little different direction, if time permits. Although it is bandied about an indefinite suspension, it cannot be said that it is a slap on the wrist. Anybody who sits out, whether it's for one day, or 1 month, or 1 year, or 2 years, or whenever this court deems the respondent fit to be readmitted, it is a hardship. There is no question about it. This is not probation in the sense that you go home, you go to work, even on where you have electronic release, where you go to work and you sit at home. He is totally prohibited from engaging in that which he had done for the past 12 years to earn his livelihood. As testified to during the course of the proceedings, when asked, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm volunteering. I get paid a minimal amount at a Catholic services to try to perform some sort of paralegal type service. It's not a whole lot. Unless you have a second career readily available, it's kind of hard to all of a sudden shift gears and to try to maintain yourself as best as you can.
So, well, Townsville, think back over your life as a lawyer and back to law school. Probably a third of the people that you went through the educational process with, maybe more, have found other ways that suit them better than practice of law to engage in an activity that puts food on the table and shelters their family.
There's no question. Most people who go to law school probably have done other things before going to law school. And quite candidly, you know pretty early on in your career whether being a lawyer in the practice of law, depending on whether it's in litigation or corporate or government, is what you want to do. And if you find out early on this is not what you want to do, you don't do it. You have your law degree and then you go into something else.
Counsel, should it be the court's concern on whether or not an attorney who has committed a theft offense, has violated numerous ethical and disciplinary considerations, has a second job, has a second career, has the ability to be gainfully employed?
Should you consider it?
Should we consider that?
Well, I think it goes into the mix as to how you, every case is different. I mean, I can go, I did a list of the last 2 years of just theft offenses, and you run the gamut. Why? Because you consider each person individually. You consider what they did, you consider what their history is, you consider what their circumstances are, you consider whether restitution has been made, you consider the victims.
Speaking of that, your client hasn't made any, has he?
Well, has the victim been made whole? The answer is yes. Has he paid it back? The answer is no. I mean, the victim of this theft was a beneficiary of the public policy, insurance policy that everybody in this room contributes to. That person got reimbursed in full from the client security fund. So Mr. Dadisman paid into that fund, I pay into the fund, Ian pays into the fund. So yes, the victim did get paid. Did Mr. Dadisman reimburse the fund? No, the answer is no.
So should we consider the fact that he has not yet met that obligation?
Well, again, you take everything into consideration, but the question is why? Is it because he's sitting on, you know, a Swiss bank account and decides that he's going to keep it, or is it because he doesn't have the money? I think the evidence was clear. He is without funds. He is not somebody who is living well on this interim suspension.
You referred to one theft, but when a lawyer takes money from a client, promises to do the work, does not do the work, and does not return the fee, that sounds like, you may want to use a euphemism, but it sounds like theft to me.
And you've said so much. I mean, I'm not questioning that is what this court has.
There's a pattern. Isn't the problem with your client? There's a pattern. This isn't one incident. Even the one incident is bad enough. But we took him. We removed him from the practice in our interim, as you know, our interim authority, because we were concerned that if he continued representing clients, that there would be more clients who would be harmed by him. So you have there's a pretty high hill for him to climb, is there not, to convince me that he should not be disbarred?
Well, that was the opening comment. If had he not had this one major item that is almost an automatic, I may have brought to this court's attention certain facts which may have questioned whether the board properly found misconduct and certain other issues. But because of this theft, and in my opinion, how this is overbearing on everything else, I didn't want to sort of argue what I thought were lesser matters, not unimportant matters. But to me, I mean, this is the major issue. As it relates to the taking of the money for the bankruptcy, there would have been, as I said, some argument, some challenge to the board's finding given all the testimony. But I didn't do that, so I guess the answer to your question is yes. Given what the board found, that would be correct. But under the circumstances, you know, as this court knows, you know, you pick and choose sometimes what your arguments are, and sometimes you don't present all of them. And I didn't present all of them because, as I said, I think this is the most significant argument that.
Well, you don't have the most easy client for whom to argue, Mr. Portage.
Well, it's actually the board recognized that.
We appreciate that.
The one opportunity that he had to try to tell the member, and as clear as I said, tell them why you should keep your license. And he still had a difficult time articulating it. And candidly, not all lawyers
I was a little surprised at that. He's asked why should you keep your license? He had no idea. Well, now that alone would, with me, puts a bell on.
Well, Your Honor, with no disrespect, some people, as soon as they sit in a witness chair, raise their right hand. Sometimes it's not as easy to engage in a conversation as it may be in your living room. And the fact that he's a lawyer doesn't remove him as a human. I mean, he still has human frailties and human tendencies, and sometimes may not articulate as every other human in this room has been able to do. So I'm not, again, it's not an excuse, but that's what goes into all of the consideration as to Michael Dadisman individually. And again, this court has, whether it's on theft or on other occasions, and I made reference to the Colombo matter, where looking compassionately towards an assistant county prosecutor who had violated the public trust, you suspended him, but you put in language in that decision that, again, I think applies in almost every circumstance, and that is, do you give people hope or do you take it away? And here you had a person that, in other circumstances, would have been disbarred. This court has disbarred persons for such an offense. But you said this person was entitled not to have all his hope taken away. And that's all Michael Dadisman asks. To come back to the practice of law, I mean, is the Mount Everest of tasks. He has to pay back everybody. He has to convince a yesterday afternoon with a colleague of mine, we sat and interviewed a fresh-faced, bright-eyed, round-faced person who wants to be a lawyer. And we asked him why. Knowing that I'm going to be here today, ask him, why do you want to be a lawyer? And then you look at him and say, is he going to be a problem 30 years down the road or 15 years down the road? No person that I've ever interviewed says, you know, I'm going to be a lawyer so 5 years I can get into problems and face disbarment. Nobody does that. They all come with these optimistic, idealistic attitudes. And sometimes things happen to change it. Something happened. And you know, it wasn't drugs. It wasn't gambling. It wasn't alcohol. Candidly, nobody knows what it was. I would speculate that he had some financial difficulties at the time. But the question is, given all of that, may he deserve, he asked this court if he may have a second chance to try to prove himself. And again, to prove himself, he has to not only reapply, but he has to meet all the other conditions. He's got to keep his CLEs current. He's got to do a ton of things. It is not just, you know, here's my $100 or my registration fee is what, $275 now? Here's my registration fee. Admit me. He has to convince this court that he is worthy of being taken back. Now, had his 3 years lapsed, it would have been interesting to see whether the justice system would have accepted him back. He hasn't been out 3 years for which he can apply to seal his record. Obviously, that is of no consequence to this court. But in many instances, a person with no prior history, even under circumstances such as this, would have his criminal conviction sealed and be given a second chance. All he does is ask this court for the same opportunity.
Mr. Potash, in your view, is the permanent disbarment then ever warranted by an attorney?
The answer is yes, and this is where I wanted to get to the other focus-changing opportunity. This court presumes disbarment on a theft. I'm wondering maybe it should presume indefinite suspension so that if there are aggravating factors to warrant disbarment, no different than you would do on other offenses. Why presume the worst? Indefinite suspension, again, is no picnic. So if this court were to consider indefinite suspension as the presumptive sanction, then you go, is there something in above and beyond that that warrants disbarment? And then the answer to your question is yes, there are circumstances.
Although that presumption is something that we tell new lawyers at the very beginning, this is the way you lose your ticket. You steal from a client. So we are talking about deterrence, are we not, as well as protection of the public?
Correct. But again, it seems that the attitude may be indefinite suspension is nothing, and I beg to differ. It is something. It is so significant.
Well, counsel, we all have our perspectives on this, after a while, unfortunately, one has seen from this perspective so many of these that they become a bit of a blur. But let me just share my perspective on that and have you comment on it. I believe when I first came to this court, there were a number of folks who thought disbar should be rarely used, that as you indicate, indefinite should be the normal sanction, leaving some hope, but in reality not much hope because it's discretionary getting back in, and that discretion is not granted that often. And that's really the situation we're in today, I think, even now. Indefinite is not light, and it is not easy, even when indefinite is handed down, to get back in. You have to do an awful lot. But there are a range of theft kinds of considerations as well, and we see them where some family problems, drugs, other things get mixed in, and perhaps it's one or two, and then we see the range where it's large amounts and repetitive. So one rule for all thefts doesn't seem appropriate either, does it?
Well, that's the answer to your question is yes. And one rule for all thefts does not seem appropriate, nor should this court ever do anything other than look individually at each person against whom sanctions are sought. And like any other court, you see repetitively certain types of behavior, but as much as it pains you to see lawyers come before you committing these offenses, I don't think that you will ever grow cold or callous and determine, well, if it's a theft, that's the way it is, and I don't need to listen to him anymore.
Should the consideration, because this bounces around in my mind, should the consideration, when you look at, well, this could be disbar, this could be indefinite, do you do a favor to your client if you look at it and say, I don't believe I'd ever vote to let that person back in, so if I give them indefinite, it's false hope. So if the person deciding that is looking at it and saying, this doesn't look to me like a person I would ever want to have practice law again, shouldn't one vote to disbar if that's your thinking about that particular individual and that fact circumstance?
Standing where I am, that conversation takes place on a regular basis. As to whether you really want to go through this, given the circumstance. Sitting where you are, if the lawyer asks for that second chance, then yes, even if 5-10 years down the road, he seeks readmission and seeks to prove that he has overcome the hurdles, then maybe that opportunity ought to be there, unless it rises to the level of those kind of cases that Justice Lasinger asked, you know, is there a time when a lawyer should be disbarred? Yes, there may be circumstances. I'm just saying, in the immortal words of Potter Stewart, this isn't it. And so with that, Your Honors, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Potash. Mr. Friedman.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices. May it please the court. Present with me this morning is Ronald Fry and Eric Dunbar, who were co-counsel in this matter as well. Mr. Potash, good morning. There were three issues that were raised a moment ago, and I would like to address those before I kind of get on with my presentation as I had outlined. I don't believe that this court need concern itself with whether or not a lawyer can pursue a second career. I think that Mr. Dadisman made some very clear choices in a pattern of neglect and misconduct. That concern of a second profession, I believe, should be his concern now. The issue of restitution was also raised, and whether or not the victims were made whole in this case. The respondent has focused much of its argument this morning on the Watkins matter, which was the matter for which Mr. Dadisman served 8 months in prison. It's important to note, and I think that we would be doing an injustice to the other clients of Mr. Dadisman, there are several other matters in this case. There were several other victims that were the subject of the disciplinary process that were not made whole. Mr. Watkins was, by the victim's fund assistance, the other victims in this case to date have not been reimbursed, not only in total, but even in part. And I think that in focusing only on the Watkins matter, I think that that would be unfair. As a client going to a lawyer, the matters for which they go to the lawyer are always important to them. It is everything to them. And in this matter, we know that people went to Mr. Dadisman with wrongful death cases, they went with class action lawsuits, they went with financial matters, all of which were of the utmost importance to those particular clients and victims in those cases, and I don't think can be treated any more lightly than the Watkins matter, only because Mr. Dadisman was caught and had to serve prison in that matter. That being said, The respondent utilizes a quote from State of Ohio versus O'Neill, specifically the dissent in that matter, in which it was stated that not every murder warrants death. In essence, one must look to the aggravating circumstances to determine which individual deserves the most severe penalty. And in this case, on behalf of Relator, I do submit that the instant matter could not be more serious. There can be no more appropriate sanction, or no other appropriate sanction other than permanent disbarment. And I base that on the following. We have 8 victims in this case. We have 7 particular instances of misconduct. All have several different violations of the Code of Professional Responsibility. There were, in total, 32 infractions that were found by the panel and adopted by the board for this court's consideration. There were 3 instances of, or 3 findings of lack of cooperation throughout the disciplinary investigation and process. So I believe this is a very clear case for permanent disbarment. Now, in support of respondents' claim that an indefinite suspension should be the order here, there were 2 cases that were primarily relied upon, the first being Cleveland Bar Association versus Glassman, and the second, Disciplinary Council versus Colombo. The Colombo case was cited to a moment ago. First, I would address the Cleveland Bar Association versus Glassman case, and will state that it is completely factually distinguishable than the matter at hand. In that case, it was 1 matter with 2 separate convictions. Interestingly, 2 of the panel members in the instant case also sat on the Glassman matter and began to point out the distinctions at the hearing of the Dadisman case that can be found beginning in the transcript of page 587 and continuing on to page 588. But as I review those cases, I find that there are, in my estimation, 12 points of distinction, and I think therefore it's not pertinent to the matter at hand. In that case, in the Glassman case, there was a 10-year delay in prosecution, and that was just kind of due to the fact that the case could be characterized as falling between the cracks in the disciplinary process. There was a stipulation of facts. There was 1 matter with 2 violations. There was a stipulation of aggravated and mitigating circumstances. In that case, the respondent took responsibility for his actions, provided a justification, although it may have been somewhat misplaced, for his actions. An apology was given to all parties that had been harmed in the case, and restitution was made to all parties in its entirety. There was cooperation during the disciplinary proceeding. Character references were presented. And there was the situations in the respondent's life that he felt may have contributed to his actions were also provided, and that was the death of his father and the dissolution of his marriage. Finally, all criminal sanctions in that case had been completed at the time, so he had been able to show that he responded favorably to the sanctions imposed by the criminal courts and the criminal
jurisdiction. Yeah, but all of that is different from this.
It's 100% entirely different.
Restitution hasn't been made to all the victims in this case, and he doesn't even know why he wants to be a lawyer, and he hasn't cooperated with the proceeding, and he hasn't even admitted in the Rose and the Balog and some other cases.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that also can be the distinction found between this case and the Colombo matter. In the Colombo matter, very briefly, the respondent in that case did show remorse, did acknowledge a problem, accepted that problem, and took steps to address that problem, which we know is drug addiction. So by the time that the matter had reached this court, there was also some favorable and mitigating factors to be considered. Now, in the respondent's brief, there were some other statements that I respectfully would disagree with. One in particular, I find to be, for lack of a better term, somewhat misleading, and that is that Michael Dadisman has admitted to having committed the most serious infraction. That is true that he did admit to the most serious infraction. Again, what's most serious. I don't think that Ms. Horantz or Mr. Rose or Mr. Seaman would contend that Mr. Watkins' case was any more important to him than theirs were to them. But with regard to the Watkins matter, there really was no way to circumvent the truth. He had served 8 months in prison. But even in the Watkins matter, what I would point to this court's attention is that Mr. Dadisman was not entirely forthright even in that. And that matter, per the respondent, to them is the most important instance in this case. And I would call this court's attention to the transcript at page 133. The question upon cross-examination of Mr. Dadisman was, so it is your testimony here today that it was signed, and that makes reference to the check in the case. As this court recalls, there was an $80,000 check that had been received from the insurance company and was deposited into the bank. Mr. Dadisman's answer was, I don't recall, Ian. All I know, I don't see how the bank would deposit it in there without both signatures. Moments later, Exhibit D was introduced and presented to Mr. Dadisman. That was a photocopy of both sides of the check. And once he looked at the check, Mr. Dadisman acknowledged on page 135 at line 10, the signature's not here. I think that that's especially important when we look at the facts surrounding this. Mr. Dadisman had gone through criminal litigation for years, had gone through a plea, had gone to prison. He had served time in prison, he'd been on post-release control for some time, had been involved in the disciplinary proceedings for some time, and yet still at hearing is still not acknowledging and accepting responsibility for what he had done. He is still arguing the facts of the case. There are several matters, as I had stated a moment ago, here, but I would also point, just as a kind of a representation as to what I think gives insight into how or indicates Mr. Dadisman's behavior in this case. And I would point to the Balog matter. I think that this kind of encompasses his lack of acknowledgement throughout this entire proceeding. And at page 417, Mr. Dadisman continues to attack Ms. Balog by stating, in 15 years, this is the most difficult client I've ever seen. He went further a moment later to say, I think she's misconstrued several things. So the point here is he's not been contrite. He's not accepted responsibility. He has continued to deny absolute wrongdoing in this case. The final statement that was made in respondent's brief was that at all times, Dadisman acknowledged and has been contrite about his wrongful conduct. He has never minimized the seriousness of his acts for which he served time in prison. Again, I've addressed that, the issue of the instance warranting prison time. But again, with regard to the other cases, the panel members, not only did I as counsel give Mr. Dadisman the opportunity to provide some justification, the panel members did that as well. And one of the panel members at page 550 of the transcript asked Mr. Dadisman, do you know how frustrating this is? And that comment was with regard to the neglect of the client matters. And Mr. Dadisman's response at line 12 was, well, I do, but then some people, are especially needy, okay? And that was his response to that. And that's not the type of response that would give or that should give this court comfort in giving a sanction anything less than permanent disbarment. There have been several cases that the relator has relied upon in its answer and would ask the court to consider in this case. Additionally, there have been a line of cases that have been issued since the filing of the brief. In those cases, I would submit are either equal or even less than that of Mr. Dadisman's case. In this case, pursuant to Section 10, when looking at the aggravated circumstances, I submit that seven are present. Mr. Dadisman acted selfishly. He acted dishonestly. There was a pattern, as was recognized a moment ago, of misconduct. There were multiple offenses, a lack of cooperation during the disciplinary process, submission of false evidence, false statements, and other deceptive practices during the disciplinary procedure. The victims certainly were harmed and still have not been made whole today. There's been an absolute failure to make restitution, and I believe that the only factor of mitigation, the absence of prior disciplinary record, should not outweigh all the other facts and circumstances found in this case, should not allow for Mr. Dadisman to have a sanction anything less than permanent disbarment. As the panel noted at the time of the hearing, and as was subsequently adopted by the board, the respondent was, quote, most of the time evasive, dishonest, and patently untrue. I believe here in close that the question that begs response is, why should the respondent be afforded a second chance? Why should he be able to practice law in the state of Ohio? It's been pointed out here a moment ago, and I would just reiterate, I think that the strongest answer comes directly from the mouth of Mr. Dadisman in two excerpts from that proceeding. Again, there was ample opportunity to give some reason, and even as counsel for relator, I wanted a reason. But the respondent did not provide any reason, justification, or excuse, or even apology that day. The first excerpt was found at page 537. So why do you want to keep it? And that's in relation to the license. Answer, you know what? Question, why should you? And the answer was, you know what? I don't know why. There's a lot of questions that I have not unraveled myself. There's a lot you asked me. Why? I wish I could give you the answer. Finding that somewhat unsettling, another opportunity was given to provide some justification as to why the license should be kept. And that exchange was at page 538. And that question was as follows. In direct response to the question, why should you keep your law license, you yourself don't even have a good reason for that. And the answer was very clearly, no, I don't. I really don't. So in close, I would simply state that Mr. Dadisman's conduct cannot be tolerated. In order to protect the clients and the public, to ensure the administration of justice, and to maintain the integrity of the legal profession, the relator moves this honorable court to issue an order that respondent be permanently disbarred from the practice of law in the state of Ohio.
Thank you, Mr. Friedman. Mr. Potash, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The Rose matter, again, I didn't want to argue the particulars, but if you wanted to look at the Rose matters could have been argued and challenged, especially after all they complained about. They went and saw another lawyer and did absolutely nothing. The problem is that the focus is on the theft. Ms. Balog, she may have been the most difficult client for Mr. Dadisman. She was extremely not a walk in the park at the hearing. She would not be able to answer a question yes or no. But the point is not this. The point is, if you take a look, not 1 year has gone by since the Glassman decision. Now, whether this court has said that there's no statute of limitations on a disciplinary matter and whether they fell through the cracks, the point is the man committed a theft. He was convicted of a theft. He was less than forthcoming. He did not apologize. This court, in its opinion, talks about his being less than contrite and forthright, and he gets a year. Now, granted, it wasn't suspended. I mean, he wasn't given credit for the interim suspension, but he gets a year. So there are different circumstances and different criteria applied. And I would only submit to this court that this court does not have a reputation being soft on lawyers. Maybe you think you are, but you do not have that reputation. By granting Mr. Dadisman indefinite suspension, you are not sending a message, an adverse message to the lawyers or the public. What you are doing is you are balancing the circumstances in order to arrive at what I perceive to be and what I hope you find at a just decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Potash. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.